As the energy transition progresses, it's becoming increasingly clear that we need to focus our attention on securing the future workforce, the people and skills necessary to meet our decarbonization goals. A report recently released by Enlit called Making It Work highlights the skills gaps and headcount shortfall the energy sector is facing, the possible implications of the shortfall, and the strategies we need to prioritize to address the situation. It was this report that got the conversation started. And to continue the conversation with candid insights from the front lines of recruitment, I was joined by Tom Essex, founder of Kikio, a staffing and recruitment company based in the Netherlands, and Alison Lowry, founder of talent search firm Stem Select. Tom and Alison highlight the importance of collaboration between governments, academic institutions, and the companies and utilities looking to recruit, to ensure we don't run out of people before we run out of time to reach net zero. I'm Pamela Larg, and this is the Energy Transitions Podcast. Tom, Alison, welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you today about a topic that perhaps doesn't receive the attention that it should. And that is, of course, workforce and skills and ensuring that we don't run out of people and skills before we've achieved our energy transition goals. So to set the scene, Enlit recently published a report titled Making It Work, and it provides some really thought-provoking insights into the workforce challenge and how this challenge is being perceived by the sector. So there were two stats that really stood out to me. The first one is that 75% of respondents believe that the skills gap could prevent us from reaching our tripling renewables goal. And the second one is 83% of respondents believe that workforce shortages are threatening Europe's industrial competitiveness. That just gives us a little bit of a scene setter. Clearly, this is an issue we need to be talking about. We can't ignore this any longer. Would you say, in your opinion, that this is an urgent topic that needs to be proactively addressed? And is it being addressed in the way that it should be? Alison, let's start with you.
I hate to start on a downer here, but I think we need to be realistic. We've got far more working against us than for us right now. And if we aren't tackling these challenges readily, we are going to be caught short. And I think that those stats definitely confirm what we're all feeling in the industry, that there's a lot to do and we're making less than the required effort to get there.
Tom, your thoughts?
Yeah, I would tend to agree with what Alison's mentioned just there. Ultimately, you could describe the renewable space as a little bit more modern, newer. Therefore, jobs that are being created and do need to be created almost historically haven't taken place. So I think that the deeper infrastructure around upskilling, training, learning and development isn't quite there. The way we're going, the direction that we're tracking in, probably doesn't look like it's going to be there.
We seem to be emphasizing the topic and talking about it, but very little action, tangible action, is being taken with regards to these workforce challenges. Do you think enough is being done, or is it still really just having these conversations and possibly regurgitating these concepts? What do you think?
I love that word, and you're right. We understand what needs to be done, I think, overall, but we're not really moving the dial on many of them yet. I think that we can all acknowledge some of the basics, and Enlit's report really covered a good majority of the main considerations we need to make. If you're looking at the pace of people joining STEM versus the aging workforce, you know, that's a major challenge, which means training programs, interest at educational level, investment in diversifying workforce. There's so many things that we need to do. Looking at transferable skills, there's these platforms that we need to be stood on. And I just don't think that we are really putting in the required effort to get the return on the investment yet. For example, resistance to transferable skills. Transferable skills is a big one for me. And there's still a major resistance to that. In 1 year, we actually looked at all of the job requirements that we were working on. And over 80% of them required at least 80% of the job description to be fulfilled. And the reality is there's not enough people for that in the industry. There just simply isn't. So there's a lack of flexibility on looking at a combination of soft and hard skills. That's one of many examples.
Tom, what is your experience of this as well? Do you believe that there isn't enough being done in terms of education, in terms of investment, in terms of transferable skills?
Yeah, I think customers and providers in general themselves are probably not open enough to transferable skills, i.e. looking what can be transferred, looking what other industries that we can take people from and upskill. But yeah, a little bit deeper than that, I don't think kind of governments locally are doing enough to understand what markets might be on the decline and what skills from people within those markets can be pushed into a market like this that's massively on the incline. I did a little bit more research on it since we had the kind of prep call for this. And all I could really find was a little bit in Eastern Europe. There was some initiatives that Poland and Romania had done in regards to upskilling in factory workers. And there was something I saw that I hadn't seen before in Spain, where they had a kind of transition plan from some kind of historical coal workers. But realistically, you would want this to be front and center of every government's initiatives at this time.
So what you're saying is there isn't sufficient emphasis from government in terms of the support they can provide.
Yeah, exactly. I think my point is every country that has the topic of staffing in renewables on their agenda, which everybody should really be looking a little bit deeper, specifically into their country, about how they can take a large chunk of people from a historic industry to another. Believe it or not, Poland, Romania have tried to do a little bit in regards to their kind of sea operations. So it's quite an easy switch from the oil and gas kind of workers into the renewable wind particular workers. And yeah, I think Spain are probably the only country that have got a clear named plan in regards to upskilling into the solar industry.
But it's actually quite tricky, right? Because there's areas where that transition should be easier. And we're still not seeing programs to tackle that. So where it's tricky is STEM. We all know that engineering roles, technology roles, the roles that Tom's talking about are, if you have a very certain set of skills, and those require a certain level of training or retraining. But there's also a lot of soft skills as well, where we can move people from dying industries into renewable energy. And there's lots of project management, procurement, where it's a much easier transition. So even if it's harder to tackle STEM, there's multiple different areas and subsectors that we could be tackling, and we're still not at pace. I did a roundtable about a year ago with three women in senior leadership, and all three of them came from outside of the industry. Now, they had a combination of hard and soft skills. For example, one was a lawyer, but she had come more or less from outside of renewables and moved into a role as head of Norway in the wind space. And she's one example of three. There was someone who's running solar delivery and somebody else who was the CEO of a clean tech company. When I asked all three of them how long it took them to ramp up and use their transferable skills and apply those to the renewable space, the answer was a resounding more or less 6 months. So that's not too dissimilar from what it takes anybody really to start to acclimate to a new environment. You look at those soft skills as well, and that I feel like could be a very easy solution to solve some of the problems, at least outside of STEM. STEM, I think, requires a separate discussion. And I think where we need to start seeing that is in more rigorous programs that look to either train from outside of the organization, or also retraining and training investment internally. The UK spends something like 1-3% of salaries on training programs. This is bare minimum.
A lot of the talk we've done so far in this opening 10 minutes or so has been external and governmental and what can they do nationwide. But there's some really interesting points made there about how quick the transition was. This is a little bit more within industry. What can the major players do to actually break the stigma of the industry a little bit? And just, yeah, almost trust some of the soft transferable skills. It's like a snowball effect. I think once one or two of the big players are open to it, then others may follow.
Tom, I have a question. When you say the stigma of the industry, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, it's relating to Alison's point a few minutes ago when she mentioned sourcing within the industry. If companies within the renewable industry are recruiting for roles that might not be within the STEM sector, so might not be super technical, something like a procurement manager or somebody in HR, but they are still adamant that individual needs renewable experience, which does happen from time to time, then by breaking that stigma, companies being prepared for somebody to come in without renewables experience, trusting that their softer skills and business knowledge will get them up to speed in a quick period of time. But yeah, from what I see anyway, a lot of the non-technical roles still come with a tag of somebody who's got experience in the renewable industry.
Yeah, it's pretty surprising to me how many organizations, when taking a requirement from them, are so particular about the industry background. I've mentioned the stat before, over 80% of all of our jobs, and I think it was 2023 we looked at, required this. And we're not really creating the opportunity, you know, to move the dial, but also even in STEM. So I read a case study about basically they had used their local community within STEM. So they were training women, for example, on electrical work. And they ended up bringing 1,200 local women in the area into STEM-related positions. So it is still doable. I think we want to separate STEM out from the transferable skills topic sometimes, but other times we don't need to. This is still possible. We can still train into these industries and we can still tackle STEM-related challenges specifically alongside roles where we can maybe transition with a softer skill set.
Alison, Tom, one of the highlights that really stood out to me with this report was the fact that we need to address skills gaps, but also headcount. So there's actually a lack of a potential workforce. That's a serious situation that we could potentially face. We need to start looking at how inclusive we are and how we can increase diversity, because at the end of the day, there might not be sufficient workers if we're only looking at men, for example, but if we start to employ more women or perhaps groups that are currently underrepresented, we might not have such a big problem on our hands. Now, Alison, I know you're quite passionate about this topic. How do we address the lack of diversity and inclusion? And is it an issue around the messaging that we send to market? What are your thoughts?
I don't know if it's really about the messaging. That plays into it. But I think we're still at the place of actually putting these programs into place where fair wages, for example, are offered. The wage gap isn't a joke. The UK is operating a 20% wage gap on the whole. There's a lot of things that we can be looking to address, but let's be honest, we're 50% of the global potential workforce as women. So we're all, I would say all underrepresented groups have equal merit. But if you look at gender diversity, there is a very large pool to tap into here. And really, we're only scratching the surface. And I would take it even further. It isn't really an option whether or not you have a two-income household now. It's almost a requirement to get by in a lot of countries. So we need women out there working in a lot of cases. And hats off to those who are working at home and are providing in that way. But where there's the opportunity and where women are wanting to work and where women are wanting to be included in this area of the industry, there's a lot of opportunity to upskill. We can regurgitate all of the typical tips and tricks on how we do that, better messaging around job description. Is that really making much of a difference? Unless we're starting to offer remote opportunities, job sharing, and really actually providing opportunities for women to enter the workforce in mass, we're paying a lip service, right? We're virtue signaling.
Yeah, it's quite funny actually, because Alison mentions that as women, we're 50% of the workforce, but you could argue there's potential to be more than that. So I think the studies vary, but in the last couple of years, higher education certificates, 62 or 63% of them have been completed by women. And yet when you get to the kind of mid to higher echelons within any company, renewables or others, there's disparity with where the women are. And that isn't down to women getting jobs. That's down to how women are treated when they're in the jobs. And to be honest with you, most of the disparity happens around the first kind of senior promotion, right? So around the jump up to kind of associate director or director, which is might be the time that a family's been started, or might be the time that a lady needs to go and take time off from maternity. And that's the issue that we're facing. I feel that's the issue we're facing, not women getting into work. I think we're covering that. But actually, what's happening at that kind of period, that really vital career period? Are we really, like you say, giving the flexibility that we need to around home life, around school life, around getting the job done as opposed to where the job is getting done?
Yeah,
I think it's a huge topic.
Yeah, I think we can talk all day long around we want the right person for the job. That's always the case. Of course, we want the right person for the job. But I think we need to create the right environment for the right person for the job in doing so. And if you actually look at the statistics, the reality is, yes, in a lot of renewable energy areas, so solar is the one I can probably talk on the best. I think it's something like 32% globally women in the industry. I think it might even be higher than that, maybe 38%. Apologies, I don't have that exact number in front of me. But if you actually look at the functions that they're doing, these are not leadership positions. The majority of the time, these are administrative functions where they don't have a seat at the table. Adding salt to the wound, despite all these stats clearly showing that we have a lot of work to do. On top of all of that, almost 50% of men think that we've gone too far with DEI. So not only are we not even really having a seat at the table yet, we're already being told to slow down because, yeah, we're there. We've gained our equity, which is interesting because effectively at the end of the day, you've got a group of men who are sat in a boardroom making the decisions, and they're looking left and they're looking right, and they're not sharing that table with a woman. And yet we're saying that, thumbs up, we've successfully achieved DEI with women now. 50% of men think that's good. Yep, we're good to go. So I think also the perception of DEI is a whole nother layer that we still have to tackle.
Alison, I really enjoy how you painted that picture for us. A group of men sitting around a boardroom having these discussions, thinking we've made it. Now we can really just abandon all DEI initiatives. But, you know, we really are facing quite a serious situation. Because in order for us to reach our decarbonization goals, if we aren't investing in the right skills, in the right people, there is just simply no way we're going to be able to ensure a sustainable energy transition. We are going to run out of people before we run out of money to fund this. So, okay, now obviously I realize you don't have a crystal ball and I realize you don't necessarily have all the answers to the questions, but where do we start? This is clearly a systemic issue. So from the boardroom, we've got a lack of focus or a lack of emphasis, perhaps. We've got a problem where we're not creating environments to attract the right people. Where do we focus our attention first in order to start solving these issues? Tom, I'm going to shoot this question over to you first. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, my thoughts are, what would I do in this position? I think there's a number of things that need to happen. I'll try not to go into crazy detail in any of them, but a realistic kind of skill mapping. What skills do manufacturing, oil, gas, construction workers have? That we can transition to renewables. I think some kind of academic, fast track academic programs in schools, in colleges, in universities, that's proactively fixing the shortage or trying to fix the shortage that we all know that we're going to have. I think there's a partnership approach that could be with are the leading players in the industry, government working with renewable energy companies to try and commit to a certain percentage of graduates going into the space within the first year of completing their studies, and potentially a hiring incentive on the back of that. I think there's probably some changes in some stigma that still needs to happen that we just discussed on the D&I point. Just from a pure STEM perspective, how many women are going into these technical roles despite holding the majority of the degrees in them? I don't know the answer, but yeah, you're at least planning for the future a little bit.
I would say there's a three-prong approach because we need government to get more involved. We need education to step up and start working with government. And we need organizations to hold themselves to task when it comes to these programs. And then within that, we have those layers around what programs within education, what retraining and reskilling and upskilling we have. And those kind of fall under everyone to government, education, and industry to be a part of. And it's very disjointed. So everything Tom is saying, all of these concepts are floating about independently. And where you're not seeing a lot is where these different entities are coming together to create an EU-wide or UK-wide solution. There's been a few. The SES network, that basically funded by UK Research and Innovation, they have started working together. So they pulled together three or four of the major universities in the UK to start bridging the skills gap within the solar energy sector and working with the next generation coming in for researchers to bring people into the industry. And you're seeing examples like that at a smaller scale. The biggest one, and I think the one that is probably most impressive, which I think probably in and of itself, if they can do it, really will start to turn the dial, is the European Commission. They have partnered with InnoEnergy and have pledged to bring in 65,000 workers into the industry through training programs. And that's a big figure, right? We look at the UK, and I've seen a couple of different quotes, depending on what area of the industry you're talking about. It falls between 200,000 and 400,000 people that we need in order to really move towards hitting net goals. And so if you look at the figure of 65,000, it's making a good dent, right?
A good dent indeed.
But we need to be doing this at scale, and we're just not yet.
I would like to ask a question around what you are seeing in terms of the industries that are attracting the most talent at the moment. Tom, and I'd like to start with you. Are there specific industries that are really winning the messaging war, as it were, and really attracting the young talent, the next generation? Or is it not really one specific industry that you would say is taking the lead?
Do you mean renewables aside here?
Renewables aside, yes.
Yeah. The kind of blue collar engineering, low level engineering, construction, kind of site based jobs are what's suffering the most, right? I think over the past kind of 10 to 20 years, the influx in people going to university has got greater and greater. The level of people's degrees has got higher and higher. The amounts of people with higher education has got higher and higher. The kind of traditional, well, if I go UK-based, the people that used to not go into higher education and go into maybe like a vocational learning and pick up a trade or a skill or kind of a site-based role, that's declining massively. I think the renewable energy sector will feel that because there's, on any given project, on the utility scale projects that we work on, as well as the highly technical engineers, developers, project managers, there's a core of people needed to do the basic civils construction, the health and safety, some of the more, I would say, vocational tasks. That's an area that's suffering, right? It's not, nobody wants to go into that anymore. There's certainly a hell of a lot of people in the UK in particular going into those types of roles. And for that reason, it's difficult. In terms of an industry that's really pulling young people into, maybe Alison can contribute.
It's interesting. I only know technology, and obviously it took a pear-shaped in 2022, as we all know. And if anything, there was an opportunity there. And I'm not sure whether or not we capitalized on that. So turning your question on its head a little bit, when the IT industry took quite a big hit, there's a lot of organizations in renewable energy where those skills are in high demand. And I wonder how well we actually ended up scooping up that talent. You look at clean tech, for example, and there's a lot of software engineers, programmers who have an existing skill set where they could very easily ramp up and move into clean tech organizations. The rate of SMEs in industry is growing. We are where it stagnated a little bit more recently, but overall, that's an area of growth. And that's where we can be using transferable skills. And I'd question whether or not we did very well in accomplishing that, because we had an industry that was suffering and we had some really great engineers, software engineers sat on the bench. It's incredible for a significant period of time. So I would say, if anything, I could comment on what industries are booming. Cybersecurity, that's a big one. It always will be, but I don't really know if it's, to me, it almost feels like it's comparing apples and oranges a little bit.
Yeah, Tom, you mentioned that there's perhaps a declining interest in vocational training, and it would be interesting to understand, why is there such a movement towards universities? The blue collar positions, that's what really keeps the sector moving.
Yeah, I completely agree. As to why, I can give my opinion. I think the majority of industries, jobs, companies over the past 10 to 15 years have added more and more educational requirements into their specifications. And therefore, I think that has forced more and more people going into higher education. I think if you go back, 30, 40 years, the types of people that would go on to a university would be the really kind of top, most intelligent people who would then go on to become lawyers or doctors or things of such. And the quality of degrees and people going to higher education in the past kind of 20 years has probably declined. I think we could admit it's easier to get a degree than it might have been 20 years ago. There's topics that it's probably easier to get a degree than it was 20 years ago. And I can even remember when I was coming through school, you were really pushed to go to higher education, pushed to higher education. If I knew the things that I know now about the career paths that a technical skill or a vocational skill could have taken you on, then my opinion might have been massively different. So for me, yeah, I think there's a couple of things. I think companies' entry requirements have got tougher, as per se. And yeah, kind of schools and colleges have pushed people more and more into higher education because of that.
I think what's really interesting is it seems like there's still a lot of students that don't really even know about renewable energy jobs. They've done quite a few polls on this. And when being asked about opportunities within the green space or renewables, many students don't even have an answer to the question. In fact, don't even know about a good majority of the jobs that exist. So there's a major gap in education within universities to encourage them to start looking at the options for them in advanced education. And then also in school, let's take it to secondary level. If we go back to the topic about women, girls lose interest in STEM subjects by, Microsoft did a study on it, by like age 15. But the interest levels are still quite high when they're 11, 12, 13, and then they just drop right off. And a lot of that is societal. It's what Tom was saying about the societal opinion of those, that kind of work. So we've got, our job is twofold. We need to be starting those discussions and starting those topics about what opportunities are available to students in first and secondary. And then that really needs to be continued in advanced learning so that they know whether or not they even want to go into a four-year university degree, or if they do, as Tom says, want to do something more vocational. But when you're being presented with these decisions with such a lack of understanding about them, we can't expect them to be going down the path that's going to be best for them because they don't even know if it exists. So I think the education piece is critical, and we're not getting it right.
Tom, did you want to weigh in?
I think the secondary education kind of ages 12 to 15 is such a good point. Yeah, exactly the same when I was at school. There's just a stigma there that kind of men or boys go in a certain direction and females going in a different direction. And yeah, there's probably a lot more to fix, let's say, at that age, at that point, than a lot of the things that we've aforementioned on this conversation, yeah.
And also more locally as well. Not only do they not know about these jobs, there's a lot of areas of the UK, for example, where they live in an area where there is either large-scale utility plants or manufacturing plants. And again, it was a study I read, they were students or young people within that area did not have any advanced education on local opportunities available to them. So why are we not talking to them more? Why aren't, you know, these organizations themselves taking the responsibility of advertising, training programs, internships when they're in school? I don't know about you, Tom, but I never did any, and this is going back a little while, but I never did any kind of hands-on like training when I was in school where you'd go spend a day somewhere and learn how they do and what went. Never, not once. Why are we not getting our kids involved in what kind of jobs are out there and go doing a field trip where they do some on the job learning? Did you, Tom? Did you ever have anything like that?
No, but I almost mentioned this point a few questions ago when Pamela asked me about what I would do or what do we need to do. If you take the UK in particular, there's a lot of towns, small cities, areas in the UK where unemployment is increasing, where historical manufacturing industries are on the decline. There should be programs whereby children in the secondary schools, kids in the colleges, are given a fast track into utility projects, whether it be a wind farm off the coast or a utility solar project. You can help employment, you can use the local population, and at the same time, drive an interest in newer jobs.
I love that idea. And I think that this is one of the ones I was pondering on when I think about, okay, what's the solution? And we all sit here and think, okay, what's the best way to do this? It goes back to that three-prong approach. If governments were getting more involved with incentivizing universities to create programs where organizations could create paid internships, and we were all working together to create a path that was not too costly, does not require the kind of prerequisites where people could do on-the-job training, and this could be wrapped into educational programs. So they're getting their vocational education. There's grants and there is potentially some payment relief on those particular programs because they're helping us reach net zero and the government is getting involved to sponsor that. And then organizations are creating these internship programs to boot, and all three are working together to create that trifecta of support. Then we would probably start to get somewhere. But it takes collaboration.
Alison, I feel like that just summarized everything. That whole idea of collaboration, breaking down silos, getting the academic institutions, the government, the organizations that are to be employing, and just really getting the message out there, the education, the awareness from such a young age. I wish it was more simple. I wish we could just get the ball rolling and stop regurgitating, which I feel like is the word of the day, and actually start really implementing some of these action plans. Again, we have so much to talk about, but we have actually run out of time, which saddens me greatly because this is such an important topic. But if I can ask you, Tom and Alison, for your final concluding thoughts, is there something that you'd like to see happen in this space within the next 5 years, for example? Obviously, we're aiming for 2030 in terms of some very important decarbonization goals. So hopefully we can get everyone toasting the marshmallows around the same campfire pretty soon. What would you like to see? Alison, let's start with you.
I'd like to see people who are not already working in the industry start taking this more seriously. Sometimes I feel like we're in an echo chamber and we need policies to be stronger. We need education to grab the reins and start creating programs. And we need institutions to take their internship and their diversity, equity, inclusion programs more seriously. We have got to stop virtue signaling. We've got to start acting.
Tom, your final thoughts?
Yeah, if we are serious about achieving our goals, I think the real question is, we're going to see how serious the world is about achieving our goals here. I think you would want to see a huge change in government's response to this, the big players in the industry's response to this. Probably I would put higher education and universities in that as well. What are they doing to attract people before studies and to help with people after they've completed their studies?
The time to get serious about this is clearly now. Tom, Alison, thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing your insights. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And thank you to our listeners. I will be including a link to the NLIT report, Making It Work, in the text. Feel free to download the report for more insights and strategies to mitigate the workforce challenge. Until next time, goodbye. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Energy Transitions Podcast, brought to you by NLIT and Friends. That's a wrap from me, Pamela Log, and our producer, Kamo Motse. We hope you can join us next time. Visit nlit.world or subscribe for more episodes.